Sarah, would that be for you? Of what we did, or at least part of what we did. So yesterday we introduced an object, which is an integral over the space of
M planes in CN. The only way we know how to talk about it is by introducing coordinates which are redundant. So we have to divide by the volume of GLM. We impose conditions that tell us that we are integrating over all M planes, which are orthogonal to some lambda tilde plane, which is a two plane. It's also orthogonal in a formal sense to a 0/4 plane. And it contains the formula is too long to write here. I'll write it here. Well, let's write the whole thing here. Missing a 1 to M. Okay. So you guys were able yesterday to recognize that this delta function, all it's doing is asking that our M plane contain a particular 2 plane, which is called the lambda plane. And this delta function is telling you that our M plane is orthogonal, or must be orthogonal to the lambda tilde plane. OK, very good. Now we also carefully work out the number of integration variables that are left after we impose all the delta functions. And we decided that this is going to be that this is really an integral, or we found that it's an integral over m minus 2 times m minus 2 variables. Okay? What else do we know about this? Well, we made several claims. So the claims were, that residues of LMM are Yangian invariant. Okay, so this infinite dimensional symmetry that we found by putting together the generators of the superconformal group and the generators of the superconformal group when acting on the same object. We also claim that the residues contain all leading singularities of n equals 4 superjambians. To all orders in perturbation theory in the m, n sector. Okay? In particular, the claim was also made that BCFW terms that Dima talked about yesterday are contained in the set of leading singularities, and therefore BCFW terms are residues of LMN. This means that we can write down any three-level scattering amplitude as a sum over some residues. Okay. Nima gave you the full solution, or precisely what the residues that come here are, four NMHV amplitudes. Okay, this is the M equals 3 or K equals 1 sector. And he said that, well, this is not very difficult. Remember that in this case, the number of variables that we have to integrate is really an integral over m minus 5 dimensions of the minors Okay? This is the effective integral that we have to perform after all the delta functions have been used. This is what we have to do. And he introduced a notation that if we are choosing a residue, the way we compute the residue is by choosing setting n minus 5 factors here to 0. And the way we denote such a residue is by saying which minors we are setting to 0. And he introduced a notation that if we are setting minor ii plus 1, I plus 2 to 0, we denote that just by the first number, I. Since we have to choose n minus 5, we have to give n minus 5 numbers. And the claim was that the three-level amplitude, 3 comma n, is giving us a sum of even, odd, even, which is funny because it's 1, 2, 3, but all the way to the last number, whatever it is, so that we get to n minus 5, okay, would be even or odd, depending on n. And the numbers that appear here are in an increasing sequence. Okay, this looks very mysterious. I mean, where could this formula possibly have come from? Well, that's what we're going to try to understand today. But as Nima pointed out yesterday, each of these terms are very, very strange objects. They are full of non-local poles. All these poles are true poles of each of these objects, but they must be spurious in the full amplitude. Okay? And he was able to show that you can relate this formula to a formula where you can replace or you can start with the odd guys. This is more natural somehow. With a minus sign. Okay? And the two formulas happen to be the same thanks to a sequence of global residue theorems. That's what he showed yesterday. It's also true that the set of spurious poles that you get here is different from the set of, the set of unphysical poles that you get here is the same, is not the same as the set of unphysical poles here. And that means that those poles cannot be true poles of the rational function in Vn, and therefore they are spurious. Okay? And so that's the way you see that you can build something that is local in space-time. But that's still not very satisfying. So there are several questions that one might ask when giving a formula like this one. The first question is a physical one. Okay? We know that if we have an S matrix and we have field theory, we know very well that we have particles. We know how to deal with particles. In particular, we know that if you have a massless theory, you can remove a particle, or you should be able to get rid of one particle by taking a soft limit. Okay? So the question is, where are the particles in this formulation? In other words, how is Lmn related to other m prime and m prime, where you increase the number of particles or you decrease the number of particles? Okay. Yes.
The scattering data that is Jungian invariant is some combination.
Any Jungian invariant is a combination of residues. Yes. Yes. Any algebraic function. That is the claim. Okay. But before we go to the physical motivation, there is actually a math question that you can ask, which sounds interesting. Perhaps it's not very physically motivated, but it certainly sounds interesting.
Especially when you start to learn about multidimensional residues.
And in order to pose a math question, let me start to tell you a little bit about the way mathematicians think about multidimensional residues, so that you know why we ask, or why it's natural to ask this question. So if you have, the way you define multidimensional residues is the following. It sounds a little bit counterintuitive, but that's our friends mathematicians sometimes do things that don't look very natural. But imagine that you want to define a multidimensional residue in B complex dimensions. So the first thing that you have to do, you would say, well, the first thing you have to give me is the integrand, right? The thing that you want to compute. But no, mathematicians will give you a map, and then they will start saying, well, given a holomorphic map from CD to CD, then you say, well, what am I supposed to do with a holomorphic map from CD to CD? Well, you will see. This holomorphic map is just a fancy way of saying that they are giving you D polynomials of any degree, just D polynomials in the D variables. So each of the Fi's is a polynomial in D variables. Now, they will tell you, well, given a holomorphic map from CD to CD, we can define a functional that we will call res of F. Then you say, well, now what are they talking about? Well, this is supposed to be, it's a functional, so you're supposed to put in here some function and get a number, and get a complex number. So this is a map from the space of functions to the complex numbers. And what could that possibly be? Well, Nima basically gave you what it is. But let's say that you have some function, and you plug it in here, h. What is it? What is the definition of this? Well, in order to define it, they will also say, well, this functional also depends on the complex point z star. And let z star, they will say, be an isolated zero of f. Well, that's simply a point in CD that sets all these polynomials simultaneously to zero. And we are assuming that if you move slightly away from it, at least one of the polynomials stop being zero. That's all this means. Okay. Then this would be the fancy way of saying, well, compute an integral, dz1, dz2, up to dzn, okay, where you put h in the numerator. And guess what? You put the product of all the f's in the denominator. That's all they mean. Of course, they have to give you a contour. So this is a contour integral. So the contour is going to be a torus, a d-dimensional torus. And the torus is defined by taking the faces of all these. You define the modulus of fi very near. You try to solve this equation very near z equal to z star. And then you find that, well, you can solve these equations, f of z, near this point, okay? You can solve this equation, but these equations have a space of solutions, right? This is just taking the mod of this function. Therefore, any phase will be a solution. There is a space of one-dimensional solutions of this that is compact, and that space is nothing but an S1. It's a circle. You have p polynomials, so you got yourself these circles, and that's your TD, okay? Now, they will also tell you a fancy word like, well, you have to introduce the orientation of the torus and everything, but that's also a fancy way for saying that when you evaluate this, the physics way would be to make a change of variables and call each of these SIs, new variables, UIs, very near this point. And we all know that you have to pay a Jacobian. Okay, and as we said, you have the Jacobian inverse there, and you h of z here. And depending on the order that you have here, you can pick up a minus sign. if you swap the order. Okay? So the ordering that you have here is what they mean by the orientation of the TV, of the torus. This all depends on Z here, right? I mean, yes, thank you. Thank you, yes. Very good. And then we said, Nima said yesterday, the day before yesterday, that, well, the way you define this is by simply the Jacobian evaluated at Z equal to Z star times H evaluated at Z star. Okay, very good. Now that you have this, the first time you see it, you say, well, it sounds great. I mean, you have a map and so on. Oh, another, okay. Thank you. Excellent. So it's very good that you're paying attention, because today we will do many computations, and let's see if I get them right, because I'm not starting very well. Okay. The first time you see this, you say, well, every time I have something, maybe when I'm talking about residues of something, I should be talking about maps from CD to CD if I want to be fancy. Moreover, all these global residue theorems that Nima talked about yesterday, global residue theorems, the way to state them in generality is to say that if you define gamma to be the set of all Z stars, meaning the set of all zeros of the map, okay, then if you sum over all local residues of H, F, and Z star with Z star in gamma, you get zero. Provided there is a condition about the degrees of H and the degrees of F, okay? But that's not very important for us, because it's always satisfied. So I won't bother to tell you precisely what it is. Okay. Now, when you're given this, you say, well, could it be that the three-level amplitude is actually given by some kind of map? We just define a map, and then all the zeros of the three-level amplitude happen to be, all the residues that contribute to the three-level amplitude happen to be the zeros of the map. Well, let's start with n equals 6, okay? That's the first case when we have an integrand here, right? It's a one complex dimensional integrand. And let me denote the minors like this, as we were doing before. And we know that M3 is equal to 2 plus 4 plus 6. Okay? Does this formula apply to just n equals 6? So the question is there any map from C to C whose zeros are precisely 2, 4, and 6? We're going to call it F6 because, well, it comes from n equals 6. Oh, well, let me just, for the moment, just keep this notation. Well, the answer is yes, of course. There is a natural map, which is 2 times 4 times 6. You just take this polynomial times this polynomial times this polynomial. All the zeros of this polynomial happen to be the three-level amplitude. Now, you could say immediately, no, wait a minute, there is something wrong. You said that if you're summing over all the zeros of the map, the global residue theorem is telling you that you get zero, right? But remember, that's why you have to read the mathematicians' things very, very carefully. They said that this was a function of the space of holomorphic functions into C. But H, in our case here, is 1/1, 3, 5. And this is far from being a holomorphic function. It also has poles. That's why we don't get zero when we sum over this. But still, we could say that the three-level amplitude is equal to the sum over residues Z star, where the Z star belongs to gamma associated to this F of tau H over F. That looks very nice. It's a very compact way of saying what the three-level contour is. Just give the map and find all the zeros of it. then you get excited. You say, maybe that's the right track. We're on the right track, and we will be able to put all this formula together into just the notion of a map. Then, of course, as a good physicist, you say, well, let's try n equals 7. If it works and n equals 8 works, we're done, right? Well, let's try n equals 7. What do you think? Is it going to work or not, or is it not going to work? It's a trick question, because if I'm talking about this, it's probably because it's going to work, right? But if I'm asking you the question, maybe it's because it's not going to work, right? Okay, so n equals 7. Well, clearly from this formula, we can write it down quickly. Must be two, we have to write all increasing sequences with only two numbers. 2, 5. Because it has poles. It's metamorphic, but it's not polymorphic. 2, 7, 4, 5, 4, 7, 6, 7. It's not polymorphic on the whole Riemann sphere. It's not polymorphic on the complex plane. If you remove those points, then it's truly polymorphic. That's why they invented the word metamorphic, just because it sounds nice. Well, take derivative with respect to z bar. Do you get 0? If you remove the puncture, if it, on the puncture sphere, it is 0. And then you're right, it's holomorphic. Okay, very good. So you have this thing. Now you say, okay, great. So what do I need? I need n equals 7 means that I need a map from C2 to C2. Okay? Well, let's start. After all, we're on the right track. We got the right formula there. Now, in order to get these to be the simultaneous zeros of these polynomials, say this one, we have to put the minor 2 here and the minor 3 here. Clearly, right? We want to find these points in C2 as the solutions of sum of setting two polynomials to 0. Well, this one was found by setting minor 2 to 0 and minor 3 to 0. Remember, these minors are polynomials in two complex variables. Okay? So, well, okay, let's see. 2, 4, 6, 5, 7. So that's your proposal. Excellent. Well, there is just a slight problem here, right? How many zeros are there of this map? 9, right? And how many zeros we need? Only 6. You say, well, it's not bad. 9, but we need 6. It's more or less. So you would say, oh, it's okay. Well, but just to be completely sure, let's try n equals 8. Okay? You know, when if things didn't work out precisely as in this n equals 6 case, you might start suspecting that there might be something wrong. So let's do this one. So you have 2, 3, 8 plus 2, 5, 6, 2, 5, 8 plus 2, 7, 8. Okay, now finally we move to the 4, 5, what? This would be 6, 4, 5, 8. And what else do we need? Do we need anything else? Well, I guess we need 4, 7, 8. Okay, running out of steam here. 6, great, we're done. Okay, now let's give it a shot. We need a map from C3 to C3. F1, F2, F3, three polynomials. And we start all fired up and say, well, great, we need this guy to be here, so 2, 3, and 4 must be in different polynomials. Right? We need that guy to be at 0 of the map. Well, this one tells us that 2, 3 must be in different polynomials, and 6 in a different polynomial, therefore it must be here. This one tells us that 8 must be here, so we're doing very well. This one is telling us that 2 and 6 are in different polynomials, and 5 must be in a different polynomial, so this is great. 2, 5, 8, we're doing great. 2, 7, 8, so 7 must be here, and we're doing great, we're almost done. Now 4, oops, 6, didn't work. So, okay, so too bad. So we have to start from scratch. Maybe this nice notion of having a map and all the zeros being that is not correct. Very good. Okay, so that's life. We just wasted half an hour. Let's now do physics. You say, well, I didn't succeed doing math, so maybe I should do physics. All right. So, what do I want to do? I want to discuss particles in the S matrix. And for that, I think it's best to consider an example. So let's consider the M2, n amplitude, which by now we know very well. Okay, this is the Park-Taylor formula we have written down maybe 4 times by now. And now consider the soft limit of particle n. Okay? So how can we send the momentum of particle n to be very, very small? After all, we would expect that, well, if we have a particle that is massless, we can send the momentum to be very, very small. One way to do it, well, we can just send, remember that p is equal to lambda tilde. So imagine that we take a holomorphic way of sending the particle to zero, the momentum of the particle to zero, and we take lambda to go to zero. In this case, we could also take lambda tilde to zero, it doesn't matter. But remember, we're now thinking that we're in a complexified world. So we can freely take lambda n to zero and do nothing to lambda tilde. Well, you would imagine that your amplitude, you're just getting rid of a particle, right? So you should recover an amplitude that has one less particle. But what do you notice from here is that the numerator, fine, the nth particle disappears from here and from here. So you get straight the momentum conserving delta function supersymmetrically of an n minus 1 particle amplitude. That's great. But what happens to the denominator? Something funny happens, right? These two factors blow up. Well, let's factor them out. Okay. Let's write whatever is left here. Well, you see, this piece almost looks like the amplitude with one particle removed. All we need for this thing to truly be the n minus 1 particle amplitude is just a piece of n minus 1, 1 here. See? Well, if we put it there, we should put it here. Okay? And this is what you will find in books. They say, well, when you take a particle to be soft, what you find at this level is a singularity times the m minus 1 particle amplitude. Well, how do they know that there is a singularity? Well, imagine in Feynman diagrams. You have a Feynman diagram where you have particle m, any particle I. In this case, remember, we're doing color ordering, right? So if we want to talk about what happens to particle n, we only care about what happens to particle m minus 1 and particle 1, because particle m must always be between these two guys. Now, if particle n in a Feynman diagram comes out of an internal propagator, okay, and it becomes soft, nothing happens. Nothing special happens. But imagine that particle n comes out one of this line, from this line or this line, okay? Now the momentum of particle m is pn. The momentum of this particle is pn minus 1. But the momentum of this propagator, which is a propagator, is pn plus pn plus 1. Now what happens when pn goes off? You develop a singularity. Now, of course, we know that these singularities in the end, they have a purpose in life. You can resum these singularities, and when you compute the scattering amplitude, including the quantum corrections, the divergences that appear in loop amplitudes, the infrared divergences, cancel against these real soft emissions. Okay, so they have a physical purpose in life. Very good. Now, perhaps NEMA will need that the following fact. Notice that the M stays the same. Okay? So we call this an M-preserving soft limb. NEMA will talk about today, he will talk about M-decreasing soft limits. And these ones will have a universal factor of the form course, probably you won't. I'm telling you now because so that you can try the exercise of recognizing this formula in what he's going to talk about. Because probably he will do it in momentum twisters. So your job is to find this formula in what he's going to tell you. Okay? Yes.
Being VCFW.
Yes.
Shifted.
Yes.
Why is that happening?
Well, that's precisely what he said. He said, if you take the particle n, or the particle 6, right, and you take it soft, it's as if you're adding it between particle 5 and 1, right? And that's precisely what is happening here. It's as if you're adding particle n in here, okay? Yes, indeed. Very good, very good. That is the opposite operation. He defined the inverse soft operation, right? So he said that that particular term can be thought of as an inverse soft operation, like adding a particle to an amplitude. But he didn't get the full thing. You see, it's not that cool. That's what we're going to do. We're going to get the whole thing by doing just introducing one particle and getting everything in one shot. He could only get one term. Well, yeah, he thinks he's cool, but... Oh, this is our failure. Maybe we should keep it there. It's good to remember when things don't work so you don't try them again. Okay, great. So what do we want to do? Well, we want to look at the Grassmannian formula and try to find particles in the Grassmannian formula. For that, let's consider the case again with m equals 3. Of course, n equals 5 is a very, very simple case, right? If you have m equals 3 and n equals 5, how many integrals do you have to perform? It's an integral over how many dimensions? 0. So it's not an integral. You just evaluate it. There is nothing to do. That gives you a nice amplitude, which is a parity conjugate version of the Park-Taylor amplitude.
replacing all these brackets by the square brackets. So that formula is something we know very well. We could say it's a, so there is nothing to be done. So there is an integral over zero dimensions of the minus 1, 2, 3, 2, 3. Sorry? For n equals 5, there is nothing to be done. 3, 4, 5, 4, 5, 1, and 5, 1, 2. Now you say, well, let's compute the formula for, let's write down the formula for 3, 6. It's an integral over one dimensions. You have 1, 2, 3, 2, 3, 4, 3, 4, 5, 4, 5, 6, 5, 6, 1, 6, 1, 2. And then you say, well, let's try something crazy. Let's see, what do I have to do to this in order to get that formula? Well, you might try and see what happens. In fact, it would be natural to try to get this formula from this one and actually introduce the math we found for n equals 6, which works. Okay? So let's see. All you have to do to go from here to here is replace 5 by 6 first of all, replace a 0 by 1. And now you have to multiply this by something. What do we have to multiply by? Well, first of all, we have to get rid of these minors. These are not here. Right? These are not consecutive minors for 6 particles. So we have to multiply by 5, 1, 2. Sorry, 4, 5, 1, 5, 1, 2. We are missing minors, right? So we are playing the same game we played here. How do we recognize something that has less particles by putting together things? And but here we're actually doing the opposite. We're playing the game of adding one particle. See if we succeed. Okay? I want this, but I want my map to sit in here, my map for 6 particles. Do you remember what the map was? It's hidden somewhere. My map for 6 particles was 2, 3, 4, 4, 5, 6, 6, 1, 2. Okay? So I want that map to sit in there. Well, if I do that, the 6 particle one, perfectly. That's why we got excited. The 7, so-so, that was Amit's fault. The 8 was my fault. It didn't work completely. Now, what else do we have to do with this? Well, clearly, we have the 2, 3, 4 factor here. And we have F6 there. That includes that factor here. So we should multiply again by this, because otherwise we won't get this formula. And we are only missing one minor of this formula. The minor we're missing is precisely this one, 5, 6, 1. It's the one that attaches particle 6 to 5 and 1. Okay? So if we multiply the m equals 5 formula by this factor, which I want to call S5.26, okay, we get this formula. Moreover, if we say that the map that we're using, first of all, it was a map from C0 to C0, yeah, there was no map. Now, if to that map we adjoin this polynomial, we get the correct map. Okay, this is all. Okay? This all sounds like a tautology, like I'm not gaining anything. Okay? In fact, it looks funny that I'm introducing this map that has this guy. So if I cancel everything, I just get my formula back. I haven't done anything interesting. Well, now, yeah, that was the major transformation I did. I deleted the 0. It became a 1. Excellent. This will be my edge, the whole thing. And this is the map sitting there, yes. That would be the edge. Now, see that the game we're playing here is what mathematicians actually think is a natural thing to do. actually going from m particles to m minus 1 particles, or from a Grassmannian to a smaller Grassmannian, this kind of projection, they don't think is very natural. They think it's more natural to say that you have this Grassmannian and you, well, like they have fancy notation, something like that. It's an inclusion of this Grassmannian into the other. They think it's natural. Well, let's take their word for and try a little bit more. Of course, you might be suspicious because trying to be a mathematician didn't pay off before. Okay, now let's continue. Now, I'll just give you a claim, and I'll try to motivate it. The claim is that if you start with the way to construct LMN, okay, since this thing works, maybe we just have to keep doing it, okay? To go to the 7-particle amplitude, we just multiply by another factor like this and keep going. Yeah, shall we do it for... Okay, so here is a claim. You start with a formula well, we will have the full m minus 5 dimensions, right, because we're doing this one. So you start with a formula with the h for n equals for n minus 6, which is the h for that corresponds to m minus 1 particles. Well, if you want, we can do m minus 1. Okay. You put the maps that you find by doing this operation. So let's call this one F6. The next one you get F7, all the way to Fn minus 6. Okay. I'm just trying to give you an inductive construction. Okay. So you start with that object, with the 5-particle one. You multiply by the stiff guy. Then you multiply by the same operator, the seventh with particle 7 and so on. And you construct the nth particle 1 by multiplying by this operator, which I'll define as follows. It's going to be given inductively. Here it is. You introduce particle n, okay, in between n minus 1 and 1. See that that's what we did for from 5 to 6. Now you multiply by the minors that should not be there. Okay, so it's like saying you have n minus 1, 1, 2, n minus 2, n minus 3, and 3, and you're attaching particle n here. Okay, so before, the minors that you want to get rid of are these minors, n minus 2, n minus 1, 1, n minus 1, 1, 2. Okay. Now there is this strange factor. This is for m equals 3. Very good, thank you. This is for m equals 3. And we have to introduce the final component of the map, so we extend the map. The previous map was from cn minus 6 to cn minus 6. This was the previous map, and we want to extend it to a map from cn minus 5 to cn minus 5 by simply adding the new polynomial that I've just defined. Okay? So what's the motivation for this strange operation? This one. It's just, oh, I didn't tell you what Fn minus 5 is. Okay? This is what? This is going to be n minus 2, n minus 1. No, we're just doing a straight generalization of our only success so far, which was 6. Okay? We're just generalizing. Yeah. Yeah. It's a very cheap way of doing it. Yeah, but maybe it's going to give us something interesting. Okay, so I multiply by this. So I get rid of these two, and I put the two that I like, right? But this guy was floating around there, and it shouldn't be there, so I have to get rid of it. Now you see that as a rational function, this thing here, so this object here, as complicated as it looks, is nothing but 1 over 1, 2, 3, 2, 3, 4, all the way to n, 1, 2. So this is the same, it's a fancy way of writing the same rational function by multiplying and dividing by things all the time. But it's exactly the same rational function. Okay, now I claim that if you evaluate the usual object, this one, and compute residues on the zeros of this map, you get precisely the three-level amplitude, nothing more and nothing less. Not like in the seven-particle case where we got something extra, and in the eight-particle case we couldn't even do it. We were missing terms. But before we see this in action, let me tell you what's the motivation for this factor, what's the physical motivation of this factor. And I think that that will also be a useful exercise in seeing how one deals with a Grassmannian formula in practice. Of course, this is at the risk of embarrassing myself because it's going to be a little bit of a computation. It might not work. But it, if it doesn't, then it's a nice exercise for you guys to find where it didn't work. Okay. So step one.
So that's why you decided to define the color 6, not with the 6, not with the 5, 6, 1.
Not with what?
The 5, 6, 1.
5, 6, 1.
Yes.
Yeah, 5, 6, 1, I had to put it by hand because it wasn't there in this part. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't there in the 5 particle amplitude. Now you will see that this is really doing something interesting. So what I want to do is to show that any residue of this formula, okay, any residue that I compute, where in the set of things that I set to zero, I set this guy to zero, will be something that in the soft limit produces the divergence, the universal divergence that corresponds to
the emission of a soft particle. Okay? We are aiming for this. Okay, maybe I should make the claim first. The claim is that we are going to look at all possible residues of this object, of our ln 3, n. Okay? Look at residues where in the list of residues, in the list of minors that you set to 0, there is a minor n minus 1, n 1 that you set to 0. Okay? That the 3 amplitude is the sum, okay, so you want the claim before we prove it? The claim is that M3, 3 comma N, is equal to the sum of the residues of our function L3N, okay? The sum of residues, residues of L3N, sum over all the zeros of the map F. Yes. And now you don't have to think. You just compute all possible zeros of this, evaluate the original formula on Tn minus 5 around those points, and you get the three-level amplitude. Okay? That by itself is nice from the mathematical point of view. But from the physics point of view, you would say, well, what are you doing? Is there any physical meaning?
I thought that there was something more deep. There didn't exist any math, but now you're finding a math.
Yes.
Excellent. Very good. Well, can you answer why am I able to find a map and before I couldn't?
She's a controller.
No. Is there anything in this map that I'm using which was not available to us before? Before,
you were using particle M's.
No, before we were also using it. But before,
that's quite a special tab.
Well, look.
Look at the labels of the map, right? Is there anything strange here? Well, remember, before we were trying to build a map out of these guys. The last one is not consecutive. We're introducing a new structure in it. That's the key. Okay? We're introducing now non-consecutive minors in order to build this map. This is not that crazy. I told you that mathematicians don't have any reason to choose only the consecutive minors. So actually, these are coordinates of the Grassmannian. And these are completely fine things that we can use to define a map. And that's precisely the key. Okay? The map that defines the zeros is now using non-consecutive minors. But once again, that's pure math. Let's try to look at the physics. Consider any minor, any residue. Okay? Very good, very good. So here, this object is sitting in front, and we are not using it, right? Because we only have the claim is that we're using the zeros of the map F. But by using a global residue theorem, if we put this guy together with this, so we put it here, okay, we can trade the zeros of using this guy for zeros of using this guy, okay? Instead of this guy in the map, we can replace this guy by this guy inside. So the claim is that if we use this zero, we're going to find this soft factor straightforward, okay? So let's see if we succeed in doing that.
You have a map, and now you choose another map?
Yeah, the claim is that this is a map that gives you the field of amplitude, right? But I want to motivate this factor by saying that this S has a meaning. It's called the soft factor, or we like to call it the soft factor, or the inverse soft factor, because its job in life
is to ensure that you produce the correct soft singularity in the amplitude. Okay? Yes.
Then what is the soft? Sorry, what is the singular part here?
What is it? What?
Singular object. Anything like S or.
Very good. So the singular objects would be some of the residues that we have here. Some residues will not be singular. Some of them will be singular, and the ones that are singular are supposed to produce this universal factor. And everything, when you collect them, everything is supposed to give you the n minus one particle amplitude. Okay. Remember, in Feynman diagrams, if the soft particle was attached to an internal line, you didn't get any singularity. And those terms didn't contribute to the formula that I wrote before.
Okay? Only the terms that are singular will give rise to the m minus 1 particle amplitude. Yes?
Your assignment was the 0 to f.
Yes.
Not the m minus 5.
Yes. That's why I said that I'm using a residue theorem.
Yeah, can we
close that?
Yes.
Thank you. Yeah, so I'm going to use a residue theorem, okay?
Okay.
No, I'm going to do this guy together with fn minus 5, and use a residue theorem to trade the zeros of this map for zeros where I use these guys and this minor. But that's not very important. This is only to show you the physical motivation of this object and to show you how computation is done in practice, okay? So let's imagine that you're computing a residue. Yeah, in fact, so
there are some residues still we thought that if you take out a factor, you put another factor, and this is like blowing the quantum. And going from one zero to the other zero. In fact, that's what happened.
No, the residue theorem only tells you it's a connection between many, many different residues. Right? But we're not blowing up anything.
You are trading the zeros of Fn minus 5 by the zeros of the delta effect, right?
Yes, it's like a residue theorem. It's like a residue theorem. No, you have, in a residue theorem, you have the zeros of some polynomials in one dimension. You are enclosing those. And you can deform it like this, or you can deform it in the other direction and trade it for the other ones. But you're not blowing up this residue. I mean, you're not.
Okay.
Yeah. And you're deforming the contour, if you wish. Yeah, okay, okay, very good. Okay, so let's try to compute any residue of L3, N where this guy is being set to zero. So there is a trick. We can use our GM3.
Okay. To do the following, we have our C matrix. And what I'll do is that, well, I know that this one is special. Somehow the nth column is going to be special for us. I'm putting it in the middle because, well, it's special now. So one is not that special, or so n is special, so I'm putting it in the middle. Okay. Now I'm going to use GL3. We can clearly use a GL3 transformation to set any three columns we like to be the identity matrix, to form the identity matrix. So I'm going to use GL3, the GL3 gauge degree of freedom, to set this one to be 0, 0, 1, the neighbor of this one to be 0, 1, 0. So this is n, this is 1, this is n minus 1. Here we're going to have particle 2, so this is 2n, sorry, this is 1, 2, this is 2, 2, this is 3, 2. Okay, we have all the other ones here. I can also choose this one to be 1, 0, 0, if I want. And then I have all the rest here. Now here I have C1M minus 2, C2M minus 2, and C3M minus 2, and so on. Okay. So this is the M minus 2 column. Very good. So let's see. We want to set this minor to 0. But what is that minor? Let's compute it. We have to compute the minor of this 3 by 3 matrix. But now you see the trick, right? We chose this gauge where that minor happens to be precisely C1F. Excellent. So on this contour, C1N is set to 0. So that's the thing we want to remember. Now let's look up there at the conditions that the free plane contains the lambda plane. So those conditions are given by saying alpha from 1 to 3, sorry. Oh, but we're going to set it to 0. Yeah, thank you. Okay, so we have to impose these conditions from the top line there. Well, yeah, the second line on the top blackboard. We have to impose these conditions. Remember, rho is a 2 by 3 matrix, okay? Now, with this gauge choice, it's very, very easy to solve for the rows. Imagine that we're looking at A equals to 3, right? So for A equals to 3, if you look at this, all the C's are 0 except for the last one, right? So all the C's in 1, 2, 3 are 0 except for the last one, which is 1. And therefore, we conclude that rho 3 is equal to lambda 3. Sorry, is equal to lambda n. Okay? Is that clear? I'm just looking at A equals, sorry. It's not clear because you should have told me that it's not A equals 3. We're looking at A equals n. Right? We're looking at A equals n. Row 3. So with A equals n, we're looking at this column. We're summing over the column index, right? So this equation tells us, so let's write it explicitly, that row 1, C1A, plus row 2, C2A, plus row 3, C3A, must be equal to lambda A. Now, if A is equal to N, these two disappear. This one is 1. Thank you. So you're paying attention. Excellent. Okay. Right. I told you. This one had lots of chances to mess up this computation. Okay, so the next one is clearly A equals 1, and this implies that rho 2 is equal to lambda 1. This is not going to be very important, but we can also solve for the last one by choosing A equals 3, and that would mean that row 1 is equal to lambda 3. All right, so we have all the equations we need. Okay, very good. So, yeah.
More conditions, but you're only looking at sort of one minor vanishing. You actually need it.
Yeah, I'm going to claim that in order to evaluate what this factor is, all I need to know is the behavior of these minors, of the minors that appear there. And the claim is that they are only determined by that thing vanishing. The rest doesn't play any role. Well, I'm not doing, you can tell me if it's not true. I'm only going to use that C1n is equal to 0. And let's see if I succeed. But you're right, in order to determine a complete residue, I need to impose n minus 5 conditions. And I'm only imposing one condition. Okay? So let's see how far we can go. Okay, very good. So let's start
looking at the minors we need to compute, right? So this guy here is a pole, so we don't worry about that. That's the thing we're going to set to 0. But let's look at this minor. N minus 2, N minus 1, 1. What is this? N minus 2, N minus 1, 1. Well, I mean, up to a sign is C1, N minus 2. Okay, let's compute the other one. What is the other one? It's N minus 1, 1, 2. And what is this? N minus 1, 1, 2 is C1, 2. I don't really care about this one because it cancels with the one in the denominator. Okay? But we need these two guys. We need N minus 2, N minus 1, N. And this one is more complicated, but still something that I can compute. Is this, with N, is this 2 by 2 minor, which is C1, N minus 2, yeah, to a sign again, sorry. C1, N, C2, you're getting to it, N minus 2. Okay, now the last one I need is N minus 1, N 1, which is that what I need? No, yeah, N 1, 2, N 1, 2, and that one is C1, N, C 3, 2, minus C 1, 2, C 3, N. Very good. Now, the crucial observation, only using that our residue, whatever it is, whatever the other guys are, has a 0 here, okay? On the 0 of that, we can cancel these factors, and our soft factor is starting to look, or it contains the pole, which we don't care very much, but now it contains this factor, C1, N minus 2 in the numerator, that factor C1, 2 in the denominator, we're getting C1, N minus 2, C2N, and there we're getting C1, 2, C3N. Now you see what's happening. Somehow the job of the guys on top, their only job in life is to cancel something we don't want in the denominator, and we're getting that this is equal to 1 over C2N, C3N. Okay, so in order to compute the behavior of this soft factor, all we need to know is what C2n and C3n are. Okay, well, let's see if we can succeed in finding that. Let's look at this equation now for A equals n. Okay, that's what I really wanted. So let's look at that equation for A equals N. So for A equals N, this looks like rho 1 is lambda 3 times C1N plus rho 2, which is lambda 1, times C2N plus lambda N minus 1, C3N. That must be equal to lambda N. That's the equation. This equation for A equals N. Well, once again, this is zero. We don't care about that. On the residue, now remember, this came from a delta function, okay? So in the delta function, if once we solve these equations, we will pay a Jacobian, okay? So I'll give you an exercise. The exercise is to compute the Jacobian. Well, it's not that difficult. If you think about it, we have delta 2 of this equation. Okay? Now, whatever the Jacobian is, changing these variables, okay, C2n, C3n to be u and v, okay, the Jacobian must be something that is Lorentz invariant, SL2 invariant, contains lambda 1 and contains lambda n minus 1. It can only be 1n minus 1, the bracket 1n minus 1. So the Jacobian can only be n minus 1, 1, to some power, but the power must be the power you need for this to be the correct dimensions, right? So that means that this must be minus 1. So that's the Jacobian. So the Jacobian is 1 over n minus 1, 1. Now we want to compute C2n and C3n from here. Well, how do we do it? Well, just like Nima was doing it yesterday, we can just contract, right, to project out. Yes.
HN.
But because you have nothing of this is HN. There is S is here, right?
Yeah, but you are defining it recursively. So you use HN minus 1. This new formula now defines HN that you can use next to what is HN of all those factors.
Well, as a rational function, this thing here is nothing but this divided by this.
Correct.
Right? I mean, it's easy to write what HN is in general, but we will do it for the seven-particle amplitude in a second. But let's not lose track of what we're doing, because otherwise I'll never get it right. Okay? We're just one step. We just have to solve these difficult equations and plug in them here, and remember that there is a Jacobian. So let's do it here so that we don't lose track of what we're doing. So we want to solve this equation. Imagine that we contract with lambda n minus 1, the whole equation. Okay? If we contract with lambda n minus 1, we denote that by saying n minus 1, we get a 1 here, C2n, this gives 0, and this gives, okay? Now let's contract with 1, so that this vanishes. This doesn't vanish. Okay?
T1n, right? Mm-hmm.
Okay, very good. Solve these equations, plug them in here. So what do you find? You will find n minus 1, 1 squared divided by n minus 1, n, n 1. But remember, there's a Jacobian. Okay? So taking into account the Jacobian here, we find
So you're just integrating out one column of the XE matrix.
That's not our file.
You're just integrating out one column of the XE matrix by using this cursor
view. Yeah. We have reduced, we have integrated out one column. So everything goes to something with one decimal. Right? That's a way of mapping.
But there are many more things. It's not completely obvious that there are not more factors which also contribute to. Is it obvious that everything else there does not contain brackets with n and y?
That any other factor we not.
We only looked at factors, right? We look.
Mm-hmm.
Why does everything else?
Yeah.
All the lower f will have.
So h is independent of c. Columns.
No, what you can do is to sit down and show that if you don't using the same gauge fixing, if you don't contain this, if you don't set up this minus to zero, okay? What?
No, it didn't. It was all the other minors, the smaller minors.
Yeah, so. Sorry, remember that all I wanted to do was to motivate the factor I use. And I have done that. I wanted to motivate the introduction of this factor as a way of mapping from n minus 1 to n by introducing a particle. And the way I'm showing that this has physical meaning is by showing that this factor precisely goes down to the singular factor that comes out when you try to take the particle up. Okay? Now, still remains to be seen if this guy actually
reproduces what we know is a correct amplitude. Okay? And that's what we're going to do now for n equals 7. There is a general proof for any n. The proof is not going to be much harder than what we're going to do for n equals 7, but we won't have time to do it in full generality. So that would be an exercise for you to generalize it to all n. And that's what we're going to. I'm claiming that this rational function is identically equal to this. Yeah? Yes. Yes. Oh, times this. Oh, yeah, sure. That's a recursive definition. Yeah, so that's if that's what you wanted, yeah, we can write it. Yeah, so what Pedro wants to write is the definition for Hn. Remember that the definition for Hn is the following. We have n minus 5 tau Hn divided by F6 all the way to Fn minus 5. Only the maps appear here, and everything else is called Hn. So the recursive definition is Hn is equal to Hn minus 1 times anything that is not the map. Right? Anything that is not an F should be shuffle into the definition of Hn. So what is not in the map? Well, this factor, clearly. And these factors in the numerator. Sorry, I didn't understand before what you wanted, but yeah, but this is nice to write down. Sorry? Yeah, but it's nice to write the formula. So this is a recursive definition of H. And this is a recursive definition of the map. Now, all I have to show is that this is meaningful. Yeah, sorry. So I've been using Fn minus. Yeah, sorry. So I think confusing the notation. Yeah, sorry. Okay, great.
Sorry?
In the first one, n minus 1, not n. Right? You don't want to duplicate n.
Yeah, that's right.
Instead of where?
S always has n, so it's n minus 1.
The first one. In the we are f6 up to fn minus 1.
That's right.
If n is equal to x.
No,
sorry. Sorry. For 6 particles, it's just f6, right?
Because
but you have f already, with
s1 over
f6.
You're right. This is the n minus 1 part. Yeah, you're right. Okay, very good. Well, it's good I said at the beginning that I needed help to get everything, every factor right. So this is great. Okay, now I think it's correct. Yeah. Okay. So the prospects of getting the next one right are actually going are becoming even smaller. But we got this one reasonably well, isn't it? So we got our factor, and we learned how to gauge peaks and how to use equations in practice. Okay.
Is it true that that integral with that map is equal to the integral where you remove one of the factors from the map and replace it by the factor that you are using now? You have some map now.
Yes,
right? Can you remove one of the minors from your map and put instead this, the one that we just computed the residue of? This n minus 1, n 1?
Oh, if I can just put this guy instead of the...
Instead of the one of them. Is it true that it's equal or not?
Yes. By the global residue theorem. Wait a second. No. Because we have to be careful. H is not... H has force, right? Mm. So the global residue theorem has to be applied with care because H also has force. And remember, in order to get that global residue theorem, H has to be a polynomial. Okay?
I think that if not, you know, that this is the only thing that contributes to the factor.
Yeah, that's the thing that you have to prove by induction, right?
We haven't proven that. All we did was to give you a motivation, and the only purpose of the computation was to show how the computations are done in practice. But let's try to do the... Let's use this map for n equals 7. The same thing, but it's just harder. That's a... There is no such a thing as a wrong gauge, right? Well, I could argue with that. If you choose a different gauge and it takes you 3 days to do what we did in 10 minutes, I would call that the wrong gauge. But but the answer should be the same. Okay. So let's do the case n equals 7. So this is our function. Okay. And what is this? Well, the claim is that we are supposed to write this in the fancy mathematical way and say that this is an integral over yeah, so I have to be consistent with the notation. Okay, and this is what we call H7. Okay, so I have to give you, according to our definition, I should construct an H and F's so that as a rational function is exactly equal to this. Okay, so F6 is the one we constructed before, right? 2, 3, 4, 4, 5, 6, 6, 1, 2. And F7 is now 5, 6, 7, 7, 1, 2, 2, 3, 5. No, this is H7 now. Right? This is the final answer. This is where, this is this. H7 happens to be 612235 divided by 671123345. Okay? So the first one who should jump out and say that this must be wrong, must be a myth, because he would say, oh, just like you told me before, the number of residues is 9, right? The number of zeros of this map is 9, and we only need 6. Well, let's see what happens, okay? So let's see how come that 9 zeros, so we have 9 zeros, but we only need the formula that we have on top that has 6 terms, okay? Now what I want to do is the following. I want to use the map to tell me where to compute residues and what the residues mean. I don't even want to look at this formula. I only want to look at this formula. After all, this is a rational function we're computing. And I want to see what the residues of this guy is on the zeros of this map. Okay? So that's what we're going to do. Okay, great. So you're getting that sounds like you're going on the right track, and then you say, great, so everything that is not there must not give us a zero. So let's write down the zeros we get. So we get okay, from here we say this is 2, 3, 4 with 5, 6, 7. That's what we call 2, 5. Great, that's there in the list. This guy with this guy is 2, 7. Great, we're doing well. This guy with this guy is not here, nothing. Okay. Which age? No, I told you, don't look at this formula. We're computing the residues of this thing. Why are you looking at that? Well, even better, right? H is zero, right? So it must be, if you want more support for the fact that this must be zero, that's even better, right? Okay. So that's what we get from this one. Now, this one with this one is 4, 5. Great. That's there. 4, 7. That's there. 4 with this funny guy is not there. This one is not here. It's also here. So with this, we don't get anything, nothing. Oops. We only got 4 terms. That's precisely the key. But once again, I told you explicitly, this is incredible. You never do what I say. I told you not to look at this formula. We're computing residues of this formula. We're only caring about what happens to this guy on locations in C2. That's all we care about, right? Well, looks like a sad end of the story. After all this, we didn't get the right answer. Of course, that's what we thought at first. But now if you think a little bit more carefully, I'll tell you a little bit how to think about this in a nice geometric way so that you don't have to write down equations and so on. And the idea is the following. This is a geometric trick. Remember, we have three rows, but we have n columns. So now I would like to think about the space of columns as being n points in C3, okay? Each column is a point in C3. Okay, that's great. Now, I don't really want to think about these as vectors in C3. I would like to think about them as being points in CP2. Okay? So it's like if you have R3 and you have these guys here, remember, the overall scaling doesn't really matter for relationships about the vectors, whether vectors are proportional to each other or not. This is something that has nothing to do with the overall scaling of the vector. Only the directions matter. And therefore, it's more natural to think about this. So at first, these guys are n vectors in C3. But I really would like to think about them as n points in CP2. Okay? If you don't like CP2 and all this, you can think about them as real vectors, if you wish. And they are vectors in R3. And these are endpoints in RP2. So that's even easier to imagine. Now, what is the condition that a minor vanishes? If you have minor ijk equal to 0, what is this telling you about the points ij and k? That they? 2 points. Well, yeah, that's one way of satisfying this equation, but the most generic solution to this, what would it be? You have 3 points. They are collinear. In CP2, they are in a line. They are on a line. Okay? Very good. So now let's see. Armed with this, we are ready to go back and see what happens to the other funny guys. Okay? Remember, we discarded, the first one we discarded was this one with this one. Okay, that's the first one we said, no, nothing interesting is happening there. So that's the location where points 2, 3, and 4 are collinear, and 2, 3, 5 are collinear. Remember that this, yes, that's very important, but remember that all these polynomials are linear in the variable that we have. If we had more variables, if these were higher order polynomial equations, there would be many solutions. There would be several solutions, but these guys are only linear. Remember that the C matrix must contain the first two rows are the lambdas, and only the last row is a variable. So these are linear, and the only solution that we have a unique solution, and that solution is a collinearity solution. And that's a very good observation in more complicated cases when you have quadratic equations. And that will happen when you go to m equals 4, which we're not going to discuss today. You can have several conditions, and some of the conditions will end up implying that j and k are actually the same point. But let's go back to what we're saying. The first guy we discarded was 2, 3, 4 equal to 0, 2, 3, 5 equal to 0. That point in C2, we said there was nothing interesting happening. But let's look at our geometry. This is saying that 2, 3, and 4 are collinear. But this one is saying that 2, 3, and 5 are collinear. So if 2, 3, and 4 are collinear and 2, 3, and 5 are collinear, that means that 3, 4, 5 are also collinear. So this means that on this 0, this is also the 0, it could also be expressed as the following condition, 2, 3, 4 being collinear, and 3, 4, 5 being collinear. So this is the residue that we would call. Now, this guy is in our formula here. And this is the residue that we would call. So these are the new guys we're getting, 2, 3. But that's great. That's one of the guys we were missing. Very good. So let's continue. That was it for this guy. Now this guy, we discarded this thing, this with this. Well, we have 2, 3, 4 equal to 0. And, sorry, this is 4, 5, 6 we're doing. 4, 5, 6 equal to 0. And 2, 3, 5 equal to 0. So what's the picture? We have 4, 5, and 6 collinear, and 2 and 3 collinear. Can we read any other condition from this? Is there any other special thing happening? Doesn't look like, right? Nobody else is collinear with anybody else. Okay? So this, in fact, is not a singular point of our integrand, so we get 0. We don't get any residue from it. So we get nothing from that guy. Now let's continue with this guy. So this was fine, but now we have to look at, sorry. We said this guy is giving us nothing at all, but now we have to go back and check more carefully if any of these three guys will give us something interesting. Sorry?
230?
The residue? I'm putting in a box here the new guys we're discovering that were not obvious.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So what I'm saying is that on this, on the point in C2 defined by this equal to 0 and this equal to 0,
mm-hmm.
is exactly the same as the point that you find by setting this to 0 and this to 0, which is an honest point where we can compute a non-zero residue of our object. And in fact, it's one of the guys we were missing. The top, the first one, the very first one.
Okay.
We were missing 2, 3, and we found it.
Okay.
Now we are also showing that the other guys are not giving anything. So this one is not giving anything. So let's continue. 4, 5, 6 with 5, 6, 7. That one was already there, right? That's 4, 5. Sorry, I missed. We were here in 6, 1, 2. So 6, 1, 2 equal to 0 with the first one, 5, 6, 7 equal to 0. Let's draw the picture. 6, 1, 2, 5, 1, 7, nothing. Okay? Let's look at the next one. 6, 1, 2 equal to 0, 7, 1, 2 equal to 0. Now let's draw the picture. This is 6, 1, and 2. And this one says that 1 and 2 and 7 must be collinear. And this implies that 6, 7, 1 also vanishes. And now these two guys are minors of our object. In fact, they define in C2 the point that we call
6, 7,
which is great. It's the last guy. Isn't that funny that the first guy we missed was precisely the first one we wrote down, and the last guy we find is precisely the last guy there. So now we just have to show that this with this gives nothing, but that's obvious, right? 6, 1, 2 collinear, 2, 3, 5 collinear.
We also have a graphical also for understanding.
Yes, yes, indeed.
It's always the first step.
Yes, remember, the signs.
The signs precisely come from that, yeah. Yeah, from the ordering of the S. That was the whole point of the first part. Yeah.
Residue, you find 0.
You compute the residue, you find
because
0.
Because you know that the Poisson expression has no such poles.
Yeah, that's right. All right. So, I think we can call it a day. Well, at least a morning. All right. So, tomorrow, we will see how this construction, by doing
just a slight deformation of these maps, will bring us directly to the construction of the twister string theory that Ed Witten proposed in 2003, coming completely out of nowhere from this by introducing a one-parameter deformation of these maps. Okay, and that would be very, very nice because there is another property which is completely obvious from a Lagrangian, which is completely obscure from this point of view, which is good. That's your slogan, right? The things that are obvious there are not supposed to be obvious here. And that is that if you have a UN theory, okay, and you have a scattering amplitude, so UN is equal to U1 cross SUN, and imagine that you have a scattering amplitude where you scatter a photon and try to produce gluons. What should you get? 0, right? The photon doesn't talk to the gluons. But if you compute this object, okay, if you compute this partial amplitude, remember that we strip out the color structure, right? So there is a trace with the T's and so on. Each trace by itself will not be 0. You replace one of the generators, one of the T's by the identity, that is your photon. But the thing that this thing multiplies, which is the thing that we computed, doesn't know that there was a photon. We completely strip out the structure of the color structure. It's completely out. So the objects we compute, this M, N, and these amplitudes, are non-zero. Okay, but somehow, miraculously, when you add them up with the corresponding color structure, they must add up to 0. That is called the U1 decoupling identity. And it's completely non-obvious from here. But tomorrow we will see that with this one parameter deformation and connecting to the twister string, that property will become manifest. Okay? All right. Thank you.